Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 15, delivered on October 16, 2013. The title of this lecture is Applications of the Time Value of Money.
Today, Applications of the Time Value of Money. To begin this lecture, I'm going to, first of all, remind you of a formula, the capital asset pricing model, which says that the rate that you use for any kind of analysis that you would want to use where there's a discounting involved, and I'll say the discount rate for a project is going to be the risk-free rate plus the rate, the beta of the project times the expected to return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate as a quantity. We call this expected return above risk-free, and then this beta is the risk of the stock, the non-diversifiable risk of the project or portfolio or whatever, relative to the market portfolio. And of course, the case of F, as I said, is the risk-free rate. Little side note here, just as a point of reference, and I'll somewhere in the book they actually do bring this up, but it kind of comes at a time. There's a timeliness to it right now. Is that the Nobel Prize in Economics was just handed out a couple of days ago, and it was given to some rather famous people in the world of economics and finance. One of them was a fellow named Eugene Fama. Now, another one was given to a gentleman named Schiller, and then there was another one given out to someone else. But interestingly enough, Fama and Schiller have very different theories, or if you will, hypotheses about how markets work. Eugene Fama was famous for proposing what is called the efficient market hypothesis. Which posited, essentially, to a certain extent, this is captured by CAPM. Finally, they recognize this huge thing that is used, or it used to be used. Now, today's modern financial people, financial economists, will dismiss the CAPM. Oh, we don't use that anymore. In business, yes, you do. In investing, now they use all kinds of bizarre stuff. But here's what the efficient market hypothesis says in a nutshell, is you can't beat the market. The market is impounding information so quickly in prices that there would be no way that you could actually get ahead of the market. As soon as information happens, the price of a stock or whatever is going to have that information in it. And anything like these people who look at charts and these people who look at all these numbers and all this and analyze for trends in a stock, that's all complete nonsense. It's worthless for you to do it simply because before you could ever act on that information, it has already gotten to the price of the stock. And so you can't get there fast enough to do anything about it. Now, there are different forms of the efficient market hypothesis. Some say only public information is in the prices immediately. Some say public and private information gets in there too fast for you to move on. And then there are different versions of it. But the efficient market hypothesis simply posits that stocks will, at any time that you look at them, be accurately priced relative to their risk. The risk of a stock will be reflected in its price immediately. So anything that you think you could have that would beat the market, you're dreaming. And we know that for sure. At least for the average investor, you're never going to beat these houses that have streaming newsreels and information tickers and connections to the insiders. They're going to get that information into the stock price before you could even see it, much less know how to react to it, much less could you actually react to it. Also, another thing is that suppose that there was, you knew that there was a, you had, okay, we'll do it like this. You're in bed asleep. Now, obviously, before bed, you brushed your teeth, you washed your face, you put on your jammies, and you said your prayers. And you said, Lord, please give me some insight into the markets. So in the middle of the night, you feel this glow around you. It's warm. And you open your eyes, and there's this light shining down on you. And you hear the angels, Hosanna, and I come to you, my son. Who is your daddy?
You.
Thou hast found favor with me. Buy Microsoft in the morning.
Thank you.
There is going to be a 1 penny difference between the CAPM price and the price that will be posted. Do this in my name. And then I float away, and the angels Hosanna. So you wake up in the morning, and you call your broker, E.F. Mutton. Hi, buy that stock. And sure enough, within about 5 minutes of you buying that stock, the price does nudge up 1 penny. Obviously, I was right. Well, of course I'm right. I'm Jesus. Okay? Look. So you get your transaction from the broker. Incredible. You bought thousands of shares of that stock. You made a penny per share on a fast trade. It popped up. You sold it off after you had done that penny movement. So you got a capital gain of 1 cent per share. But you are not happy. Why not? Why isn't he happy? Anyone know? It's obvious. Well, he's a simple man. You know, he asks for very small things in life. He actually lost money because his broker fees are going to eat up that and more. You know a penny stock price differential? You got it down. You got CAPM. You see the price is 1 penny below the CAPM. You push it up. You buy it. You get that penny. You get 2 pennies. You get 5 pennies. You get 10 pennies. You're not going to make a dime. You're going to lose money on the transactions fees. You will not win on that. Even if you knew for sure there was a price differential. Even if the Lord God himself had told you there was a price differential. Did I lie to you? No, I didn't. I just didn't tell you the part about transactions fees. So you see, even if you did know that there was a price differential and you arbitraged that successfully, you would not gain on it. You would lose because of the broker's fees. So you're out of luck. So you turn into a Buddhist. I kind of failed you, but the hell with you. You were ugly anyway. Efficient market hypothesis. You can't beat it. You can't do it. Even if you knew there was a price differential, you couldn't get to it. If you could even get to it fast enough, which you won't be able to, your transactions fees would be larger than any differential that you could exploit. Now, the large brokerage houses, they'll be able to do it. Of course they will. They'll obviously be able to do it because they're the ones who charge you the fees to go to the floor to do the trades. They'll do the trade. They'll make money off these tiny, tiny price differentials. But not you. Okay? So that gets you kind of excited. Well, why would I invest in a stock market if there's no, if I can't gain? I didn't say that at all. That's why when you buy into index funds, mutual funds, ETFs, things like that. You let the legwork of the transactions costs go to someone else. That's why these things have exploded in popularity over the past decade, is simply these index funds provide you the power of those large houses to make those tiny, tiny movement exploitations, price differential exploitations. So the bottom line of what FAMA was saying was this. Look, these markets are highly efficient, and you can't beat these markets. They are rational. They follow this instinct to fully and completely, rapidly impound all information. Well, that stock price is undervalued is a completely silly thing to say. Undervalued against what? Your opinion? Well, your opinion doesn't matter, Mr. Broker. You got to get these guys on TV all the time and on the radio talk shows. Well, I think this stock is highly undervalued and it's a good buy right now. What would be the reason for that? When you've got millions of powerful brokers, computers, mathematical algorithms watching every stock at every second for tiny price differentials, and he's saying that there is a sustained undervaluation that is strong enough that you can buy that stock and sustain the brokerage transaction fees and still make a profit off it, that is a huge stretch. Take that against the other guy who was given the Nobel Prize, shares it with FAMA. He says something very different. What he says is that markets are not rational in some godlike sense at all. They are driven by fear and greed. They jump at the sound of a mouse squeaking. They wet themselves if Ben Bernanke doesn't come to work on time. They pass out if someone in Congress says, I'm not going to let the debt limit be raised. They are flogged along by all kinds of irrationality, silliness, and nonsense. If that weren't bad enough, markets don't work in a perfect way to the extent that not everyone has perfect access to the markets. For example, you might know that there's a futures price that will be here in 6 months. And it's way down here right now. You know that's going to happen. The fact of the matter is that the price of the futures contract is going to go up and down through the period. And every time it goes down, you get something called a margin call. At the end of every day that you're in a loss position, you have to pay the spread between what you bought it at that morning and what you sold it at that evening. Futures contracts work like that. You want a futures contract out here, you actually settle every night. So the margin call, you know the price is going to be up here. It's down here. You buy here. You try to wait for it to get up here. If it goes down to here during the intervening period a couple of times, which it very likely will, your margin calls are going to wipe you out before you even make it to there. You're going to be done. You're out. You have faced what we call in game theory gambler's ruin. You won't make it to the place where the pot of gold is because you had to ante up every morning every night you had to pay if you were in a lost position. So you never make it to there because of the way the institutional arrangement is on those markets. Same is true if there is a massive movement towards a stock. You might call in at the same time as 100,000 others call in an order for a specific stock. Guess who isn't going to get his trade executed first? That's you, Sparky. By the time they get to your trade, the price has already gone up because of the surge of demand from those who got their trades executed before yours. You won't get there. Even though you were right, you won't get there. It's even worse than that because even as you are beginning to think about a stock. There are computers in New York that are watching what you're thinking, and they watch the herd beginning to form around a group thought, and then they execute the trade before you even have done your thing. They are looking into the future, and they say, the group thinks it's going to be up here, so we're going to buy it before they get to it. And then, when you do execute your trade, it's already up there. They absorbed the price differential on your thought, on you and the herd. They got there, and so they drove it up. So by the time you get to it, the price has already gone to where you thought it was going to be. You didn't get anything. That's what Goldman Sachs is doing now. They're looking into the future. Shiller said, all of these things put together make this efficient market hypothesis completely ludicrous. Markets aren't rational. They are highly irrational, driven by fear, driven by greed. Institutional structural arrangements guarantee that there are going to be people who do have the right idea who are going to lose anyway in this market, in this kind of a system. And it can't be changed, so there you are. Fama is off his rocker. If he thinks that everything is efficiently priced at every moment of every day, it ain't. It's just going up and down because of herd fear, herd beliefs, rumors, innuendos, lies. All of that's going to get in the way of the efficient market. So there you are. So what's the fact of the matter? For you, it's Eugene Fama. Because for you, the markets are fully efficient. And that means that your best strategy is just buy and hold. Buy and hold. Just get into an index fund that's run by one of the big dogs and let the big dog do the legwork for you. Make sure that you adjust your portfolio based upon your sentiments about where you are in your life cycle, what you think about the economy and all that. But other than that, don't go buying and selling stocks because you're never going to succeed at it. For the big dogs, Shiller is right. For the big dogs, Shiller has got it down. Shiller, at that level, you can actually look down and you can see just how mad the market is, just what an insanity it is. So that gives you some insight into what's going on in the world of finance right now. But we're in the world of the CAPM. The CAPM will tell us that for all intents and purposes, this beta and this risk are intimately related by this formula. This will not give you an underestimate of the risk. The beta that we have will not underestimate the risk, and it will not overestimate the risk. So we can rely on the discount rates that we get out of this for most of our purposes. Now let's get back to the main thing. But when we look for interest rates to use for discounting and putting into the calculator and all that, CAPM is our way. That's just how it is. Until you get to grad school, and then it gets really creepy up there. Okay, so now the present value and future value. Present value, future value. You remember the basic formula was that the future value is the present value times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods, and the present value is the future value times 1 plus k to the negative t, that thing, that formula. And then there's a big massive formula for doing it for annuities, the level annuity formula. Okay. Now the ones that I brought up were the level annuities, where you have the same amount of money coming in every year for a certain number of years. Let's say for 8 years. And you remember the annuity, the ordinary annuity, the payments occur at the end of the period, the annuity due, the payments occur at the beginning of the period, all that kind of stuff. And that's all well and good. But that was for if it were a level annuity. You can do that on your calculator with that time value of money screen and all that. If it's not a level annuity, in other words, if it's jumping around, the amount of money is moving around, then you have to go to just basically finding the present value of each one of the individual cash flows and then adding them up. That's the only way you can do it realistically if you've got a complex non-level annuity. There's an odd little extra formula in here. A perpetuity that is a level annuity of infinite duration. In other words, we have a formula, and in fact, we have uses for an annuity that never ends. Wouldn't it be nice if you could get $1,000 a month forever? I mean, that wouldn't be enough for you for everything, but at least it would certainly help. Imagine that. Something that went on forever and ever and ever. Well, is there anything that would possibly be like that? Well, yeah, of course there is. Remember when I said a corporation lives forever? Theoretically, a corporation never dies, and in accounting, we assume it's a going concern. In other words, we assume it's not going to die ever. So the cash flow generated from a corporation is technically a perpetuity. It goes on forever. But it's not probably not a level perpetuity, but it could be. Here's one place where we can apply this basic perpetuity formula, which works like this. That the present value of a perpetuity is nothing but the cash flow, remember it's just a constant cash flow, divided by the discount rate that you use for it. Maybe from CAPM, which I just erased. Okay? Now, is there a place where that would be used? Absolutely. Preferred stock. Preferred stock is an equity, but it comes before common stock. If there's preferred stock of a corporation, it has to be paid before the common stockholder dividend. Dividend to a preferred stock. Now, here's how preferred stock works. Let's say that you have TSJ preferred. Oh, I'm sorry. TSJ 2.2% cumulative preferred. Par value, $40 per share. What that means is that if you own a share of TSJ Preferred, every year, forever, you will get 2.2% of its par value as a dividend. You will get that every year forever. Preferred stock is highly desirable to certain types of investors who want fixed income, to the extent that it's like almost a guaranteed flow of money. It's like a bond. The coupon keeps going on, except unlike a bond, this coupon goes on forever. And it never quits. And this cumulative here, if it's cumulative preferred, that means that if the company can't pay the preferred dividend 1 year, it has to pay that dividend the next year with next year's before the common shareholders can see a dime of dividends. You always have to pay preferred before common dividends. And if it's cumulative preferred and you miss a preferred dividend, you have to make that one up and all past ones you haven't paid before the common shareholders can see any money whatsoever. That's why when you're a common stock investor, you want to keep an eye on preferred stock, because that could be a roadblock to you getting a dividend. If the company can't pay its preferred, you're not going to see a dividend for a long, long time. So anyway, let's talk about this preferred stock. In other words, as I had said, a perpetuity goes on forever, a perpetual cash flow. So the first thing we would ask is, well, what is the dividend in dollars on this? That means that every year, a share of this preferred stock pays a dividend per share of 88 cents. Every year. Forever. It's a level perpetuity. It's a level perpetuity. So, we can find the price of a preferred share of this stock. Let's say that we've applied CAPM, and CAPM has told us that the discount rate is 2.0. The discount rate for TSJ preferred, cumulative preferred, is 2%, 2.0%. Well, we can now key it into the formula. The price of TSJ preferred is going to be the cash flow every year divided by the discount rate.
.88 divided by .02.
So in other words, the price of this stock, preferred stock, is $44. You notice that this share of stock is selling at a premium to par. It's selling at a premium to par. In other words, it's selling above the par value of the stock. Why is it selling above the preferred of the par value of the stock? Do you see why? CAPM says that it should pay a 2% dividend, but this preferred stock actually pays a 2.2% dividend. So in other words, traders will drive up the price of this stock to reflect the fact that it pays a little more than it needs to. Again, the CAPM says that this stock should pay 2%. But this particular issue of preferred pays 2.2% forever. So in other words, the dividend is a little more generous than it would need to be. And that will be a permanent situation with this stock. They can't change the dividend. It's written in stone forever. So because it pays a little more than the risk-adjusted amount that it should, the market's simply going to say, all right, well, let's buy this because it pays a little more than it should. So the price will be bid up to $44. Now let's say that instead that the CAPM had come out with the price with the risk-adjusted amount discount rate for TSJ preferred at 1.8%. See what would have happened if we had done that. In that case, the price of TSJ preferred would have been 88 cents a year forever divided by its discount rate of 0.018. Survey would have said 0.88 divided by 0.018. My ass. Oops. $48.89. See what happens? as the market finds a, as the actual amount the stock should have paid is lower and lower against what it does pay, the market will just keep bidding up the price of it. On the other hand, suppose CAPM had come up with case of TSJ preferred at 2.5%. Suppose that's what CAPM had said. In that case, the price of TSJ preferred would have been 0.88 divided by 0.025. And if I do that, it would have come up, the price of TSJ would have been $35.20. It would have sold at a discount to par. Again, it would have sold at a discount to par. Now, madam, can you explain to me why it's selling at a discount to par? Let's try it, okay? What should TSJ Preferred pay its shareholders? 2%. What? Say it.
The 2%?
No. What's the dividend? Oh, what did CAPM come up with? 2.5%. CAPM is saying that this stock should have paid 2.5%. What does this preferred stock pay?
2.2.
Don't be timid. 2.2, man. You know, really. Can't you see that, teacher? Yeah, 2.2. So it should pay 2.5. It pays 2.2. Okay. I should pay you $2.50. I pay you $2.20 instead. What are you going to do to me? You're going to punish me. Severely. With a belt. Leather. Calvin Klein. Oh, anyway, for God's sake, keep your mind on what we're doing here, okay? Shades of gray, no, not in finance. The hell, you know? But you see, it's going to punish the stock. The stock was supposed to pay 2.5, it pays 2.2. They're going to say, time for your ass beating. And it's going to, well, they don't say it like that. Well, you know, if it's dinner and dancing, for sure. They're going to punish the stock. They're going to sell it down because it is not giving as much as it should according to CAPM. So it will drive it down. So the stock price will sell at a discount to par. But there is an application right there of a specialized version of the present value. This is, like I said, kind of a special version. But interestingly enough, we can even extend this formula here. There's a little twist on it that will allow us to use it to price common stock. It's a little twist on it. The formula, I'm not even going to show you how you get these formulas, but here. A perpetuity with constant growth. In other words, the cash flow doesn't stay the same forever. It grows at a constant rate. That is ideally how common stock dividends should work. They should, as a company goes through its life, it starts paying a dividend. And after some period of time, it starts to grow that dividend. This formula takes a simplifying assumption that that growth rate will stay the same for a very, very long period of time. And here's how the formula works. The price of this of common stock will be the cash flow one period out. Now I'm going to get back to that. Make sure you watch that. Over the CAPM discount rate minus this constant growth rate. Now, there's one place in here you've got to watch it. The cash flow that you will use is the one period from now. So let me do a practical problem here, just to make sure you got this. ANC pays has just paid a common dividend of 10 cents per share and that dividend is expected to grow at a rate of 5% for the foreseeable future. Now, let's say we put the numbers into CAPM, the beta of ANC common, the risk-free rate, the expected return to the market portfolio. And what we got out of CAPM was a discount rate for ANC common stock of 9.8%. That's what CAPM pushed out. We used the beta, the K sub M, the K sub F, and that's what we got out, was 9.8%. So we're going to need the dividend at period zero is 10 cents. Okay? But, and again, I can't emphasize this enough. You don't use 10 cents in this new formula, in this formula here. You don't use 10 cents. You have to grow it one period. Because the formula wants you to use the dividend one period forward. I will try my best to trick you on the next test by just, I'll give you the dividend and I. If you will want with all your soul to put in 0.10 there. Don't. Grow it. The dividend one period out would be 10 cents times 1 plus 0.05. You need that one growth period. The formula just works that way. So if I said 10 cents times 1.05, I get 10.5 cents. That's the one that you use in this constant growth perpetuity formula. So the price of ANC common stock is going to be 10.5 cents. D1, the dividend one period out, divided by what we got from CAPM, 0.098, minus 5% growth rate. That's how the formula works. Again, one growth period out. Now, if in a problem, I told you, the dividend next year will be, then you don't have to do it because I've given you the D1. But in this one, I gave you D0, the one that has just happened. So pushing that in there, divided by, open parentheses, and don't forget to use parentheses, 0.098 less 0.05, close parentheses, $2.19 per share. Would be the price per share of the common stock. I should put that there, per share. That's how you do it. Now, on a quiz or an exam, I'll give you the pieces so that you use CAPM to get your discount rate. I'll give you a dividend, and I will give you the growth rate. You do just what I did there. Just do what I did there, and you will get it exactly right. Okay, that's all there is to it. Again, I'll give you the pieces for CAPM, the beta, K sub M, K sub F, so you can get your discount rate. I'll give you the dividend, and all you have to do is just put it into the formula and give me the price of the stock. It's as straightforward as that. And I promise it will be on the next test, and I'll do it on a quiz coming up. So now we have a relatively simple way. It's not perfect, and there are all these fancy models now, but it's a way that we can get a handle on pricing preferred and common stock. It gives us a way to do it at least as a first pass. And if you do it right, it actually is kind of surprising how close to the number that you would see on a ticker if you do it right. It's pretty darn good. But now we move on. And I had given you this before, and now I'm going to give it to you again. Bonds. Consumer debt, consumer bonds, notes, bills, and all that, don't work like corporate and government debt to the extent that when you take out a loan for a home, for example, your payments are including some amount that is paying down the principal every time you make a payment. At first, it's going to look like I made a payment of $297 on this car and $5 went to the principal. What's this all about? Well, that's how it works. At first, most of what you're paying will be debt service. But then, as time goes on, more and more of it will be actual amortization of the loan. But in corporate and government debt, it doesn't work like that. In this world, all the issuer, the borrower pays over the life of the debt is the interest on it. That's all they pay. And then at the end, they make their last interest payment, and then they retire the face value, how much they borrowed. So, let's say that we have new issue BLT, bacon, lettuce, and tomato. And let's say that it's 6.8% due in 2043. That's all I tell you. Price. First of all, the number of years is going to be, how many years is this going to be staying out there? How long is this? 30 years. The I percent is going to be discount the cash flows at 6.5%. So the next line in the time value of money would be 6.5%. The present value, we don't know. Wait, let me check. I keep forgetting the order of these. I apologize for that. Apps, finance. Yeah, we don't know the... But we do know the payments. And we do know the future value. The payoff at the end is $1,000. It's going to retire. It's going to pay the principal. And the face value of every bond, unless I tell you differently, is going to be $1,000. And the payment is going to be 6.8% of that $1,000, because the coupon is expressed as a percent of face. Leave the P over Y and the C over Y alone, and make sure that your payment is highlighted on end, always for these. Now go up and get back to the present value. And my ass.
Six point 5%.
What do you get for the price of this bond? What do you get? Anyone calculate it? $1,039.18. It'll have a negative on it, but that's just normal. That is the current price of that bond. Yeah. Why is it 6.8%? Because that's the coupon. The coupon is that percent of the face value is what you'll get every year as a check. You lend the company $1,000, and for 30 years, at the end of every year, you will get a $68 check. And then at 30 years, in 2043, you'll get your last $68 check, and you will also get your $1,000 back. That's how corporate and government debt works. Can you tell me why this bond is selling at a premium to par? Why is this bond selling at a premium to par? What do the markets say this bond should pay?
6.5%.
What is the bond actually paying? It's candy time. This bond is carrying extra candy. So traders are just going to bid the price up because it pays a little more than it needs to. So this bond is going to pay, and so this bond's price will be a little at a premium to $1,000. Now do this for me. What if we had had the discount rate exactly the coupon rate? What would it have, what do you get for the answer then? N would be 30, I percent, in this case would be 6.8%. PV, we leave alone. Payment, in this case, would have been $68. It would be $68, sorry. Anyway, future value, face value is always $1,000. Everything else the same. What do you get here if you use a discount rate of 6.8%? You get exactly $1,000. This bond sells at par because it is paying a coupon that is exactly what it should pay. So the debt service of $68 a year will exactly be enough to keep the traders happy where they are. So in this case, you will get the bond will sell at par. Now suppose one last time that the CAPM or whatever you used, K came out with 7.2% for the discount rate for the coupons cash flow, the cash flow of coupons. In that case, N would be 30, I percent would be 7.2. PV we leave alone. Payment will still be the $68 coupon every year. The future value will still be the face value of $1,000 you get at the end. What do you get for the price of the bond now?
You did that so darn fast. $951.34.
This bond now sells at a discount to par. Why does this bond sell at a discount to par? Can you tell me that?
It's under what it's supposed to be.
That's right. This bond pays a 6.8% coupon. Market says it should be paying more than that, 7.8. Exactly. So the markets, you're going to have people sell this bond. They're going to potty train this bond for doing what it did. That's why finding the right coupon is kind of important when you issue a bond, because if you put a coupon out there that is lower than what the market thinks it should be, you're not going to get $1,000 for every bond that you issue. You're going to get only $951 for every bond you issue. It's not a good idea. But it happens all the time. The pricing can get kind of weird, right, like that. Okay, you have just learned how to price bonds. Now, one last thing that I have to mention here in this topic is my first example there, the price is $1,039.18. The quote is $103.92. That's how you write it. That's if I ask you to quote the bond, don't give me the price. A quote is 1/10 of the price. It's just how it is. So if I say quote the bond, you say $103.92, or you write 103.92. Don't write the price. Quote the bond. Par is 100. Quote the bond. 95.13. That's the quote. Remember that if I ask you to quote me a bond, you give me the quote. If I ask you for the price, you give me a dollar price. They aren't the same thing. This is actually, I have a minor story about this. This guy who wanted to get into buying and selling stocks and bonds and all that, he actually took, you see in the tickers and the papers, it's the quote. He bought a bond and he was so inexperienced, he thought the bond really was 101.12. He thought he was spending $101.12. And his account with the broker got whacked for over $1,000. He nearly had a heart attack. He's saying, what the hell was this? He bought the bond. Yeah, I bought the bond at 101.12. Yeah. Why am I losing $1,012 or $1,011.20? Why am I doing it? What's going on here? And it took the broker a minute. Wait, you think that was a price? No, that's 1/10 of the price, you idiot. Oh, I knew that. No, you didn't. You're an idiot. But see, there. Watch that. The quote is the like $103.92. That's not what you're going to pay for. You're going to pay it 10 times that amount. Just know that for a fact. Now, I'm going to tell you realistically with these bonds that the bonds, we already know the price. We already know the price. What we really want to know is the yield. In other words, if I know the price that the market is saying for a bond, then I can go back and see what the yield to maturity on the bond is. Here's what I mean. GBX, 8.6%, 2000, 28 is quoting at 102:35. What's the yield to maturity? The YTM. In other words, what I'm going to find out now is what is the discount rate that the market is assessing right now? Right off the bat, is this bond selling at a premium or a discount to par? It's at a premium. Which means that the coupon, is the coupon too good or not good enough? It's too good. Do you see that? This bond is selling above par. So that would mean that the market thinks that it should, that whatever the coupon is a little too high. So I know before I even do the calculation that whatever comes out of the I percent when I hit alpha solve is going to be a little less than 8.6%. I know that right off the bat. Let's go. N, what's N for this bond? 15 years. I percent. What's the I percent for the... we don't know. We're going to find the yield to maturity. The yield of the bond. And now, grinding it along, what do I put in for the PV? I know at this time. What's the price of the bond? What's the price value of the bond? Negative, let me see, 102.350. Put in the price. The calculator doesn't understand quote. I quoted it. You got to put back in the price. Okay, what is the payment? What is it? $86. The coupon is the percentage of the face value that's your payment. So in this case, my payment is $86. And my future value, what do I always put in for future value? What is it? $1,000. Now go back up here and do alpha solve on it. See what happens. Then don't forget to put that negative on that PV. I'm always forgetting that. I've done this for years and I still to this day forget that negative sign sometimes. Okay, alpha solve. What do you get for I percent? 8.3%. Did I put that in? Oh, I did put that in wrong. Dang on it. I knew I was going to do something wrong talking and doing this at the same time. Okay, alpha solve. I'll be darned. You were right. The yield to maturity is lower than the coupon. That's why I was selling at a premium to par. The yield to maturity was a little lower than the coupon. You got it. I can ask it back and forth. These are great questions for quizzes and exams. And then once you get the hang of it, they're like no-brainers. There's one last little detail I need to bring up about this whole story. Real world, realistically with bonds. They don't pay their coupon every year. They usually pay every half year. Some even every quarter. The standard that you'll need is that you assume that they pay every half year. So in other words, with one of these exercises, what I would do, let's say I do it for finding a yield to maturity. Well, no, let me do it with this one first here. Let's do it with the first one that I did. Three things you have to do to make it a realistic bond so that it's paying every 6 months instead of every year. You will do the N times 2. double the number of periods because there will be twice as many checks you get. You will do half of the annual interest rate, the yield, because it's every 6 months the interest rate is recalculating. And then you will do half of the payments, divide each payment by two, because instead of $68 a year, you'll be getting $34 every 6 months. This turns it into a more realistic bond, like how they actually pay them. So if I go through and I do that, with that first bond there, what would happen is I would get 30 times 2 for N. The interest rate would be 6.5 divided by 2. And then the payment would be $68 divided by 2. And then I go back up and calculate the price. What do you get? Boy, that's not much of a difference. What the hell? Do you get $1,039.38? What did I put in wrong here? 6.8 divided by... 6.5 divided by 2. Price value, print payment is 68 divided by 2. Yeah, okay. And then alpha solve. Alpha solve. I get 1039.38. Is that what you get? Well, that's kind of a not very much of a difference. I get a 103.93. Big whoop. Not much of a difference. Over here, do this one. Do the one where we find a yield, okay? Do the one where we find a yield. Now, what's going to happen here is you're going to do 15 times 2 because there will be 2 payments every year for 15 years, so you get a total of 30 payments. You go down and leave the price alone. It's still the price hasn't changed. We said the price was $1,023.50. The payments are now 86 divided by 2. Come back up and calculate the yield to maturity. Alpha solve. The number that you get here will be 4.16143144. Is that what you get on your calculator? Okay. That is not the answer you put down, for God's sake, because that's the six-month yield. You did everything in 6 months, that gave you the six-month yield. Take your cursor clear to the end of that number and just say times 2. And move the cursor down. Okay, take it clear to the end. Just say times 2. Don't key it in or don't try to do the recalculation. The calculator will do it itself. But for heaven's sakes, with bonds and any bond I give you, assume that the payments are semi-annual, okay? So you have to give me this, but watch it, because that I percent will pop out at you. Don't forget to times it by 2, because it's reporting the half-year interest rate, because you gave it everything as a half-year. So it's going to give you a half-year interest rate. So in order to turn it back into a true annual interest rate, you have to times it by 2. That's all I have for you today. Thank you.